Welcome to the first podcast series hosted by the Department of National Defense and Canadian Armed Forces on the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325, or UNSCR 1325. The Security Council originally adopted this resolution on women, peace, and security on the 31st of October in 2000. 20 years later, the Department of National Defense and Canadian Armed Forces is still upholding the values that this resolution initially laid out for all of its members. The resolution reaffirms the important role of women in the prevention and resolution of conflicts, peace negotiations, peace building, peacekeeping, humanitarian response, and in post-conflict reconstruction. It also stresses the importance of their equal participation and full involvement in all efforts for the maintenance and promotion of peace and security. UNSCR 1325 affirms that peace and security efforts are more sustainable when women are equal partners in the prevention of violent conflict and in the peace-building process. Speaking with us today, we have Colonel Chris McKenna and Lieutenant Commander Kat Aubrey Horvath, who are both peacekeepers for the Canadian Armed Forces. This podcast will interchangeably use French and English. There will also be a transcript provided for those who do not understand French or English and would like to read along instead of listening. There will also be acronyms used throughout this podcast, such as GBA+, WPS, UNSCR 1325, D&D, CAF, etc. For these meanings, they will also be expanded in the transcript, but for now, GBA+ means Gender-Based Analysis Plus, WPS means Women, Peace, and Security, UNSCR 1325 is the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325, D&D is the Department of National Defense, and CAF is the Canadian Armed Forces. Please note that due to COVID-19, audio quality between hosts and participants may differ. Hello and welcome. We are on to another podcast with the defense team here. And today we're lucky enough to have two peacekeepers with us. So we have Colonel McKenna and Lieutenant Commander Aubrey Horvath with us today. And we are just thrilled to be asking some more questions about UNSCR 1325 and the Women, Peace, and Security Agenda. But first, my name is Hannah Rosen, and I'm an analyst with the Directorate for Gender Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion. And I'm joined by my colleague, Nadia, who will introduce herself.
Hi, everyone. I'm the coordinating officer with the Director for Gender Equality, Diversity, and Integration. And before Brigadier General José Robidoux and I joined, we were actually working with SJS in the gender integration on the CAF side of the department.
Amazing. Okay, and I'll just get our lovely participants to also introduce themselves. So if Colonel McKenna, you'd like to start, that would be fabulous.
Sure. My name is Colonel Chris McKenna, and I was the task force commander for Task Force Mali Rotation 1 back in 2018-2019.
Amazing. And Lieutenant Commander Aubrey Horvath?
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Commander Kat Aubrey Horvath. I am one of the legal advisors in the Office of the Judge Advocate General for Canada, and I was deployed to serve on Roto Zero for Task Force Mali with Colonel McKenna as his legal advisor, as a Blue Beret peacekeeper.
Amazing. Sorry, I'm just nerding out. I'm very excited for this conversation. I feel like it's one of those things where I don't know how many people, civilian or D&D alike, get to talk to peacekeepers. So I feel like this is a really unique opportunity, and especially those who have been deployed on the ground. So I'm just thrilled to get this conversation started. So I'll kind of just get us going right away with our first question. So what does UNSCR 1325 mean to you as a peacekeeper within national defense and the Canadian Armed Forces? And does this personal commitment to the resolution matter as much as the organizational commitment?
So this is Kat. For me personally, what matters really with respect to the United Nations Security Council resolution, I'm not sure many people, other than people who nerd out in my profession, read a lot of those. I'm always happy when I find someone who will, and I certainly encourage Colonel McKenna to read his fair share when we're in theater. But I think the point of resolutions like that and the 1325, for me, it's about including women in the process. And I guess what I can speak to is the fact that I was one of those women who put on a Blue Beret and went to some UN mission and served on the ground. And the point was to do many things, but also just to include women in those roles. And I will not say I was a decision maker. I was there as a legal advisor, so I have a special role. So I don't make decisions, but I certainly get an opportunity, and women like me who are advisors get an opportunity to influence decisions that are made. And I think since a task force really, in my experience, was about a team and a team providing good advice to the decision makers like Colonel McKenna, having women's voices and mine included on that team did matter. And I can tell you about, for personal experiences leading up to the deployment, I wasn't really sure what to expect. It was my first deployment. I had a 1 and a 3-year-old, and I felt kind of alone as a woman deploying. I wasn't really sure how this was going to be received by my children, for one, but I also knew that it was kind of an odd thing outside the military for women to go off when they have a 1 and a 3-year-old and leave them for 7 months. And so I expected kind of a little bit of pushback, but I did experience a lot more than I anticipated. And I had to kind of grapple with that when my son's daycare providers learned of my deployment and in front of my son asked me, well, how can you possibly leave your kids? What are you going to do? And I didn't really know how to respond. I knew I had to because my son was standing right there and it was important. And so I said, well, I'm going to go because that's my job and I'm super proud that I get to go and represent Canada and do this amazing thing. And, you know, I have a grandmother who is super proud of me going into that non-traditional role and working as a peacekeeper. But then the follow-up question was, what are you going to do with your kids? I said, they have another parent. And then the follow-up question to that, when I thought I'd really nailed it, I'd put this woman in her place, she came back with, so are you going to get your mother to come and live with your husband? And so I thought,
oh my goodness,
is this a question that we ask men when they're deploying? And I actually got to ask Colonel McKenna because he had children roughly around the same age as mine when he deployed. So I will say, by and large, this is not a question we ask men. So I think when you bring it down to the personal level for resolutions like 1325, and we're talking about barriers to entry, that kind of attitude can be really challenging for women to deal with. And so sometimes it causes us to shy away from putting up our hand to be part of this experience, to be part of those big decisions that get made because of that role that society sometimes puts on women to be that hearth and home role. When I got to theater, though, I will say things changed because I was surrounded by these powerhouse women who were there with us. We had a lot of amazing women, pilots, public affairs, G1, that's the, you know, in charge of all the personnel, and the finance person was also a female. And suddenly I didn't feel so alone anymore because these women, many more seasoned than myself, spoke to their experiences of having these same interactions for, you know, the last decade or more when they were going out on deployment and how they handle it. So just having women like myself who felt so alone going in, that was like a barrier to entry when I went. But then getting there and having more women who are part of this, having that shared experience, bringing women to the table, putting women in those roles, allowed women like me to feel like, hey, there is a place at the table for me and I belong here. And at the end of my deployment, when I came home, the message that was received by my children especially is they don't remember that I was gone. They don't talk about how their mother left them. They talk about how proud they are that I did the things that I did. They tell everyone, including their teachers, about how strong I am. And they talk about the photos that I sent home. One of my son's heroes is one of our pilots, Jackie, because he saw her flying this huge Chinook. And he's like, I want to be like Jackie. And so having a boy grow up in a world where he looks up to a pilot in a blue beret who just happens to be female because she was included is a huge thing. And I'm so honored to have been part of that experience and part of that amazing team that included so many strong women. And when I came away from it, I wasn't seeing the strong women anymore. I was just seeing the strong performers. I was just so privileged to be a part of that and have that memory.
Hi, I just want to step in. This is super positive message because I'm trying to join in the reserves unit right now and I have a three-year-old daughter and everyone keeps asking me like, why are you doing that? What are you going to do with your daughter? Well, she has a dad. And there's that conception like at large that you're not supposed to join. You're not supposed to go in the military. And I think we have to break down that barrier. So thank you for sharing that.
My pleasure. And I hear, the more I hear conversations like that, the more that those conversations take place. And frankly, sometimes they only happen when women are at those kind of spaces at the table about the shared experience. The more that we move the ball forward, and it's not just for women, it's for all of our male colleagues who support us, who are sitting around the table too, and who say, oh my goodness, you had to experience that. I never would have thought. No one ever asked me those questions.
Yeah, like you wouldn't even question it. The question wouldn't be asked. It was like, oh yeah, go for it. You know, and for us, it's a huge question. It's interesting.
Exactly. And so the funny, I think, flip side to that for my husband, who he was so supportive of me. He has a military career himself that he gave up because he was a member of the U.S. Armed Forces. And he was living across the border at Fort Drum, working at Fort Drum. And he retired in order to allow me to deploy so he could be with our kids. But then he would go to these conferences because now he's an academic. And he wanted to talk about his work and his research and his papers. And you know what people wanted to talk to him about? They wanted to talk to him about the fact that he was staying home with a 1 and 3-year-old because they thought that was the major thing that he was accomplishing. And when I would talk to people at home, even close friends that I liked, about, you know, how awesome my husband was doing in terms of a job as a dad, they would say to me things like, oh my goodness, Brian's a hero. You're so lucky.
And meanwhile, you're deployed. Like, I can't.
Where everything and everyone is trying to kill me. I'm a lawyer doing a job strapped with a weapon, and they're calling him the hero. Does that make any sense?
It doesn't. It doesn't.
So it is such a bizarre experience sometimes as a woman that even when you get to those places, the perception back home is, one, you're not doing your job as a mother, and two, your husband is the hero for being at home.
Yeah, that's honestly, it's one of those moments where I think you could just sit back and be like, what did I just hear? Excuse me, what? And I think even thinking about the fact of the, like, our men colleagues don't usually get asked these questions, is I went to a panel discussion last year on women, peace, and security, not related to government. And there was a panel of 5 men and 1 woman, and at the end of the question period, someone asked the woman panelist, okay, but your job, it's pretty intense. How do you deal with that, having a family? And then another man on the panel was like, I think we all have families. I don't know. I feel like that's a pretty normal thing. I feel like we all are kind of balancing some things right now. I don't know if that's a general question for that one person. And it was just kind of one of those things where I think that person kind of just sat down and was like, oh, like, I guess that's, yeah, sure. I guess everyone has families. But it's so interesting that even just if that woman even wasn't on the panel, would that panelist even ask that question of the panelists of how do you manage those competing priorities? How do you, it's not just a normal job. You're, like you said, you're going away for 7 months at a time. And deployments, they're not easy mentally, physically, emotionally. And so even coming back, kind of what does that look like, reintegrating back into like the family structure? And my hat goes off to you. I don't have a family. And so I can't imagine it even on that end, and never mind imagine it as a peacekeeper. So that's my two bits.
So on the one hand, you do, I mean, it was a struggle for me personally to get out the door. Emotionally, I had those conversations, as I'm sure we all do with ourselves or our spouses. Can I do this? Am I strong enough? Can I really leave? This 1 and 3-year-olds are going to change so much while I'm gone. But ultimately, I was reminded through the people that I met that this is really, it's not just about me. And I think the UN Security Council resolution kind of speaks to that higher level. It's about putting women in these positions and bringing them to the table so that that becomes normalized. And we can talk about it at the macro level, though I'm not qualified to speak on that. I can talk about it at the micro level in my household. In my household, where being a soldier going off to war in the African desert is, you know, that is not something that is the exclusive purview of men. Getting in helicopters, that is not the exclusive purview of men. What is normalized by seeing those images and hearing the stories that I brought home and me embodying it, what is normalized is that women belong in those positions, that we should be there and it's right for us to be there. And I've missed my kids a lot, but big picture, I want them growing up with that. I want them growing up idolizing someone who may not identify as the same gender as them, being a pilot, being a doctor, and not seeing those specialties as being gendered professions.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's my hope for the future, is that in general, when we look up to our role models, they're not defined by gender. I know when I was growing up, it was definitely, I want to be like this woman because she's the first in her field to do what she does. And that was my role model. And instead, I would like to be, like to see our future young people look up to people because they love the morals that they stand on, that they love the position that they hold and the passion that they bring to that position, but not anything really related to perhaps their identity or their expression of themselves. And I think that would be a lovely world to live in. But I think we're going to move on to our next question. So Nadia, do you want to take it away?
Okay, so I'm going to use a really slow French to ask this one. Avec l'augmentation des conflits et des urgences humanitaires causées par le changement climatique et le manque de ressources naturelles, les femmes et les filles sont touchées de manière disproportionnée. Que faites-vous en tant que dirigeant ou agent de la paix en ce moment pour protéger les femmes et les filles, et comment devrions-nous préparer l'avenir dans un tel contexte?
So I'm going to answer this in English, and then I might transition to some French after. But so from my point of view, I think the UNSCR 1325 resolution, you know, I think fundamentally acknowledges that men, women, boys, girls, non-binary experience conflict and suffering in very different ways. You know, certainly for me, it was my fifth operational deployment going to Mali, and everything previous to that was really quite combat focused. And so you're so acutely linked to risk-based decision-making in combat. And then previous to that, on a peacekeeping mission in Bosnia, the African experience really demonstrated to me, as we collectively as a team worked through some of the really big issues of that theater to try and understand it from the outset, and realizing that, you know, each of these groups of people in a country experienced that conflict and the situation in that country with such a different lens. And then, you know, adapting your approach as a peacekeeper to delivering the effects of the mandates you've been given in that context so that you are respectful of those really different experiences on the ground that people are experiencing and feeling.
Yeah, that's totally right. And also, like, with the augmentation of, like, a climate change effects on population, we're already seeing it with the migrations of populations. And I think we can expect that to happen more and more in the future. So the GBA Plus is going to be even more relevant at this point.
Well, and certainly, I would just to follow on to that, in Mali, we had a lot of violence that was really as a result of climate change. You had, people whose livelihoods were based on the migration of cattle, and you had the desertification of the Sahel and the movement of these sort of nomadic people down into areas that were not traditional grazing lands, that resulted in cattle grazing on essentially arable farmland. And then you have a battle for, you know, just the basic resources of life, for food and water, that occur in that, you know, surrounded by the complexity of violent extremist organizations and the complexity of transnational crime and human smuggling, all of this overlaid with, you know, the political situation in Mali. And so just to circle back maybe to the UNSCR 1325 aspect, you know, we were really blessed having people like Kat on our team who had, one, she had a real depth of experience in the United Nations writ large, but two, just brought, you know, her perspective and her experience to the table. We had a very relatively diverse group in my headquarters, about 30% female at the time, and not really by design. Sort of that was who was ready at the time that the mission was launched on very short notice. And I ended up having some very strong female voices around the table. And I would say, you know, the majority of my the big decisions that we had to make as a task force were informed by those voices. And I think that's really important that you didn't have a unique single gendered lens. You had a bit more of a diverse aperture.
Yeah, I completely agree. And there's times when I wish I could be a fly on the wall for certain operations or missions that are happening at D&D CAF, because I think from a civilian perspective, there's so many things that go on that we just can't know about or just can't understand for the sheer fact of not ever seeing a deployment, not being in theater, not really seeing that kind of lens. But I think that leads us really well into our next question, which is, please share with me and Nadia an experience where you saw firsthand how having more women included in the peacemaking or the on-the-ground processes improved the operation that you were deployed on.
Yeah, so from my point of view, pour moi, c'est... So, sujet de rules of engagement, je ne sais pas le mot en français, but ROE.
Règle d'engagement.
Règle d'engagement, merci. Et puis, c'était où... on a un engagement assez complexe à cause de le mandat de l'ONU. Alors, ce n'est pas les mêmes, exactement les mêmes règlements qu'on a, on est habitué à avoir. Alors, l'entraînement au sujet de règles d'engagement était vraiment quelque chose de nouveau dans le contexte de l'ONU pour notre groupe. Alors, pour cette vignette, j'ai demandé à notre avocat, à Kat, de nous aider, de nous donner le contexte stratégique et politique dans lequel on a dû opérer dans Mali. Et puis, elle a informé beaucoup notre approche pour l'entraînement, de mon avis, de l'entraînement pour cet aspect de la mission. Et peut-être je vais vous donner la parole à Kat pour décrire un peu le scénario.
Alors, on parlait dans ce scénario-là au sujet de l'autodéfense, la défense de nous-mêmes comme soldats. Alors, et on voulait construire une situation pour que les gens pensent qu'est-ce que ça veut dire pour moi dans cette situation, qu'est-ce que ça veut dire pour moi de réagir en autodéfense. Et le scénario qu'on a utilisé, moi j'étais là pour toutes les séances de cet entraînement. Alors, j'étais comme un fly on the wall, je pouvais écouter tout. Alors, j'ai vu quelque chose se passer avec tous les groupes, c'est que quand on parlait d'autodéfense dans ce scénario-là, quand les hommes réagissent, ils disaient comme, « Oh, moi, je ne trouve pas que c'est... » Dans ce scénario-là, je me sentais comme je devais utiliser ou je pouvais utiliser la force en légitime défense. Et c'était vraiment, ça a pris quelques temps, mais après une ou deux femmes ont levé les bras et dit, ben non, là, moi je pense vraiment que j'escale la force parce que moi, vous trouvez que les hommes disaient, moi j'aurais assez de temps pour dire à cet homme-là, qu'est-ce que tu fais? De le demander, de dire arrête ça, d'utiliser les mots. Et pour les femmes, dans le contexte, eux, ils ne pensaient pas qu'ils auraient assez de temps pour répondre. Alors, pour eux, c'était vraiment une situation où ils devaient agir d'une façon d'un plus haut niveau de force, peut-être avec leurs armes, pour résoudre la situation. So, I will say it in English too, because I think it's really important. The scenario was based on self-defense, and I got to be a fly on the wall in the room and listen to every single group, and there was many of them, doing these training together in small groups. And they would work through a scenario and say, in this situation, would I feel like I needed to act in self-defense? Would I feel like I had the right to act in self-defense? What level of force is required here? And at first, the men sort of dominated the conversation and stood up and said, oh, based on the scenario, I would, you know, react by telling the guy to stop or what are you doing, buddy, and use words or I'd yell at him or maybe, you know, push him away. Okay. And then the women slowly put up their hand and said, no, if it was in a dark room and I didn't know what was going on and I had a split second to act before something really bad happened to me, I'd be going for my weapon right away. And the reaction of the men in the room first was, what are you talking about? The threat's not there. It's not at that level yet. But then they realized that for those women, you know, if you're 250 pounds and the guy who's like, you know, pushing you in a dark room is shorter than you and smaller and you're a man and you don't have any contextual factors, maybe you think of that as, well, you know, I don't think that's much of a threat and I'm just yelling. But if you're a small woman and you're pushed into a space and you don't know what's happening and it's dark and you think, I've got a few seconds to react before something terrible happens to me and that's my only space to react, maybe I'm escalating faster here. And so one of my jobs in being a fly on the wall and all this was then to go back read Colonel McKenna on kind of the general trends that were happening. And I thought that was really important for the women in the room to start expressing how they would act so that their colleagues would know, you know, you want to know how the person next to you in a firefight is going to react. But then also for the men who are well-meaning, who are at the table thinking, oh, is that what it's like? Is that how you would feel? And putting themselves in the shoes of their, you know, sister peacekeepers and thinking, okay, that's a very different perspective that I don't naturally have.
I think it's, yeah, I think it was the, for me, it was really interesting to see the different perception and the subjectivity around hostile act, hostile intent, depending on who you were from a gender point of view.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, I mean, I'm sure many of our listeners, regardless of position within the Canadian Armed Forces or just as a civilian, can definitely understand the difference in reactions that a woman might have in comparison to their colleagues or counterparts that might identify as men. And especially in the sense of when it comes to safety and security and how we protect ourselves and how we deem security and how we deem safety and how we kind of set those standards for ourselves of, in this situation, what does safety and security look like to me in comparison? What does safety and security look like to you? And how do our personal backgrounds and the way that we identify actually impact the way that we see security, both in our personal lives and in your case in theater? And I think that's a really interesting point to kind of bring into the conversation, especially around safety of women in peacekeeping operations or in operations in general. How do we ensure that those safety measures are validated and also protected in the sense of knowing that that's a reasonable response for the contextual situations that women have been placed in within history?
It's a very fair assessment. And for me, like I had, you know, this was like my fifth mission and 27 years in the military. And I had never seen up until this point in my career, really disunity with respect to, or subjectivity with respect to how one would interpret hostile act, hostile intent, until we were placed in this much more complex and nuanced place in Mali, when, you know, the interpretation of that really had to be parsed and became something that was very differently perceived by men and women. It was really interesting.
Awesome. A bit in the sense of us peacekeeping with Canada and also as you, like as individuals, the next question is going to be more about your personal experiences. And again, I'm going to ask this in French, but please feel free to use the language of your choice to answer it. So here we go. Inclure les femmes dans la prise de décision dans les conflits que dans le maintien de la paix renforce la reconstruction et les liens avec la communauté. Comment avez-vous été personnellement impliqué dans ce genre de processus d'opération qui a mené à un résultat positif?
So, pour moi, il y avait une situation, et je vais laisser Colonel McKenna en parler, mais pour moi, c'était assez important pour, comme avocat que, et comme femme que j'ai vue. Colonel McKenna parlait au sujet de fait que les autres pays militaires qui contribuaient à MINUSMA, eux, ils n'avaient pas autant de femmes que nous. Et nous, on avait une femme avec nos polices militaires.
Non, merci, Kat. Donc, oui, il y avait une situation sur le camp que à chaque 2-3 mois, on avait une marché qui était les locaux qui entraient dans le super base de Galles, puis ils vendaient des choses, des tapis, des marchandises, oui, merci. Puis, un des problèmes que les autres pays n'avaient pas une policière militaire qui pouvait faire des searches, des fuites sur les femmes pour les laisser entrer. And, you know, and I guess in the context of Mali in a predominantly, you know, Muslim country, there are certainly sensitivities with respect to men and women interacting in a public space. And so, you know, having Canada, having the capability of having a female military police officer who could provide, you know, a search capability for our partners so that we could allow, you know, female merchants onto the base and not step across a boundary, a cultural boundary that would have really offended someone from the local area, I think was a big tool. And I don't think it was by design, a little bit by luck, very likely. But I, you know, the fact that we had someone we could use for this role was really transformational for our host, the German military who were who controlled access and security to that camp. And she provided, you know, a service that and an opportunity, you know, that they didn't have organically. And so that I think was a bit of a win on our end.
And yeah. For me, I can't speak to it personally. I was very glad to see that. And I mean, in my little LEGAD circle, so legal advisors, there were other nations there, and we all kind of got together. And incidentally, we had some powerhouse lawyers who all just, most of whom happened to be women, two Dutch, the legal advisor to the United Nations who was a civilian was a woman. The French legal advisor was a woman. So we had quite a contingency of us there. And one of the things that they would bring back from their meetings with their commanders was how grateful they were that Canada had that, even that small capacity, because that is, you know, our face to the public. That is we're there on the consent of the host nation of Mali, and are putting our foot forward and us helping the UN. So them as well put their foot forward saying, we will, you know, your women coming to the market to sell, to support their families and their livelihood, to increase the relationship between the locals and the UN mission. Now the face of it is they can go into a private space with a female peacekeeper who will perform the search. And the feedback to me just on the personal level was the lawyers were all grateful for that because it kind of helped protect their troops too. And so we all walked away feeling like this is one, like, it's a super small area. We understand that it's one person, but that one person made a big difference in the big picture.
I totally agree. And we're seeing more and more examples of local women, like on the ground, that are opening up more, like opening up to uniformed women because they feel more comfortable talking to them and they're not intimidated. And this is a lot of information that can be gathered on their situation and be helpful for the operation. So this is awesome. Thanks.
So we'll move on to our final question. So if you could implement one thing within your own team, so not the defense team, but you specifically, the operations or units you work on, be it a policy, program, service, et cetera, right now, within the snap of your fingers, that would support women, the Women, Peace, and Security agenda, what would it be and why?
I will start with kind of a non-answer, saying that I don't have a team. I'm just part of the bigger team, but... for me personally, I think we were doing all the right things. And that normalization effect that I talked about, I think is really important. None of the women there, I mean, we all work really hard to be where we were. And none of us wanted to see ourselves as the token women. But within, you know, 5 minutes with working with this group, you could very quickly tell they were selected on merit and not on anything else. And so then that normalizes it for the group. So men see it and everybody sees it, including other women. And we start treating this as the new normal, and then it becomes a new normal. So I can't speak to the higher level policy or decision, but I'm relatively new to the military. I have a privileged position as being an officer and a legal advisor in a branch that probably has a lot more women than most branches, just by virtue of the fact that these are the people that are graduating from law school right now. There's a lot of strong performing women. And now we go into a world that is, you know, a peacekeeping world where we are still the minority, but people are seeing us. And first and foremost, it's Canadians, and it's, you know, maybe our own families and ourselves, but it's also we're interacting with all these other nations, maybe who have no experience with women in decision-making roles or advisory positions. We had a powerhouse chief of staff who was a female, and she walked into these meetings, and I bet there were minds that were changed just by virtue of the fact that they listened to her, they took her, you know, wise counsel, they saw her acting, and it demystifies the process for women. So every time, yeah, we don't want to be figureheads, but at the same time, every time a man can look up to a woman like our costs and say, yeah, okay, women belong in the room, or our sons and daughters look up and don't see gendered roles. I think that's what we need to be doing. And so where we're at right now with my, you know, 8-9 years in the military, that's what we need to keep doing.
Maybe I'll answer from my side. Thanks, Kat. I guess I'd be remiss in not saying that, you know, the equipment really matters, especially when your life is on the line and you were performing a duty like we were. And we didn't really get into it, but the focus of our task force was really centered around forward aeromedical evacuation of wounded peacekeepers or civilians. And so, again, sort of the way that people were ready, we had about 50% of our clinicians initially who were female. And so these clinicians would fly in the back of a Chinook to go and pick up somebody wounded. So it's, you know, critical care nurses, acute care physicians, or aeromedical technicians, paramedics. And they wore, you can imagine, you know, our body armor, hard plates and soft armor, in addition to load carriage of all of their magazines and everything they needed to fight if they needed to. And then layer on top of that an entire load of medical gear, you know, tourniquets and bandages and drugs and saline and all that stuff they have to carry with them. And you can imagine this load becomes sort of ridiculous to manage for anyone, irrespective man or woman. And so, you know, the baseline of the design of that armor and the load carriage equipment we have is really designed for men. Even the smaller sizes aren't shaped correctly. And so there's a lot of tuning of your gear to make sure you can do your job without just hurting yourself on a day-to-day basis in 50-degree heat, under enormous amount of stress, and trying to provide medical care in the back of a moving helicopter. So, you know, my hat is off to our female clinicians who manage that load just the same as any one of their male counterparts, but also had it, you know, they're wearing it, and ergonomically was not well designed for them. And for their size and the ergonomics of their frame, I just don't think it was really fair in that regard. I would say we had to go to theater with the equipment we had, and now we are operationalizing this for future missions. We are definitely going to take a really hard look at the equipment that we give people so that in the execution of their duties, they are not disadvantaged because it's designed for the other gender.
Yeah, that really brings up the point of kind of the conversation between equality and equity. And what does it mean to ensure that women or smaller framed individuals that are being deployed on missions, what does it mean to give them equal opportunity or to give them equitable opportunity? And equitable opportunity in this case, where, like you were saying, ensuring that equipment is ergonomic for their body and ensuring that they can perform the same tasks at the same rate or strength as their counterparts, but without any physical discomfort or any increased chance of injury due to equipment not fitting correctly. And I was privileged enough last year to actually visit Base Borden for an exercise, and I got to put on a bomb suit. And that was like so heavy. And I am like 5'2". At like 140 pounds, and I truly almost fell over when I put this on. And so it gave me a respect for the equipment and that our deployed personnel wear. But on top of that, like you were saying, like if you're in an additional role, you have all your fighting equipment and that necessarily combat equipment. And then on top of that, you might have medical equipment or what have you. And so I can definitely say that it could have fit my body better. So I could only imagine that it would need to fit our deployed personnel's bodies better as well. No, you go.
I just say it really came to light in our mission. I'm sure it's been a complaint. I know I've heard my wife discuss this, my spouse discuss, you know, the kit that doesn't really fit really well. But I would say it really came to light for us just because of the preponderance of women we had in that clinical role and the very acutely operational nature of the clinical role in this particular mission set, where those who were in the greatest harm were those clinicians and my air crew and the force protection element that was attached to them. So it, you know, you really had this very closed subset of people who were taking on a disproportionate amount of the risk and having to wear their equipment in an operational way far more often than the rest of us. And it really came to the forefront in terms of even just, you know, weights on someone's head with helmets and night vision goggles. It was a really eye-opening experience, and I think we can do better in that regard.
Exactly. And I think that kind of goes back to the beginning of our conversation of these things wouldn't have even come up or been acknowledged or really understood at the same magnitude if women were not just included in these roles as the Canadian Armed Forces does so well at just really trying to increase the amount of women deployed and on operations and missions. And I think before it would have just been maybe smaller men that really were pointing out the issues in their fit, but that would have been just like a, well, you just need to be taller kind of thing instead of like, oh no, your body actually like probably could use a different kit as well. Like we all have different bodies and based on our kit, like we could probably perform better if they fit us better. So I think that's a really, really great point to end. And I like to always end, some of my favorite podcasts always end with kind of a popcorn session. So it's usually just like a quick last minute thought that you have in your mind that you'd like to mention if you didn't get to mention it before, or if you had a running thought that you're like, oh, I like wanted to say that and I totally forgot. This would be the time. So if you have any last minute quick thoughts, this is your time. Either of you can take it away. I won't kind of put the pressure on one of you or the other. So
One of my takeaways from my time in Mali was this was not an easy deployment. This was like literally everything wanted to kill us, mostly the weather and some weird bugs that I'd never seen or heard of in my life, like blister beetles. It was not easy. We were quite isolated. It was exceptionally hot. There were a lot of restrictions on people. We were very close quarters. When we got there for the first couple months, I was doing law on the back of a cocktail napkin, essentially, because we didn't have printers that really worked. I didn't have an office. So I was handwriting things out or giving oral advice. And it was a challenging situation. And it was challenging for everybody, including obviously the women that were there. But one thing, you know, when you're asked, well, as a mother, as a woman, can you really do this? I don't know when we got it in our heads. I don't know why the question comes up. Can women do tough things? Of course women can do tough things. And there's, I think, a famous quote about, you, if you want to know how strong a woman is, like a tea bag, put her in water, and then you'll see. I think putting women in Mali can just, it just shows what they're capable of. And obviously the situation, it calls for us stepping up, and we all did. But there was no sense that this was beyond our capacity simply because of gender. And indeed, perhaps because of the examples that we've given you with respect to our MP as a woman and the rules of engagement training, the fact that we were women and we were present and we formed part of the discussion made things better. And we made Canada better. And we maybe even made the UN better. And so, yes, women can do it. And also, inclusion, in my view, only serves to make us stronger. And it's not inclusion for the sake of inclusion. It really is operational efficiency. It just makes us better at what we do as CAF.
That's great, Kat. From my point of view, I guess I'd say, as the commander, you know, I had two sort of outcomes that I was really focused on. One was executing our mandate in an ethical way, safe way, and ensuring that, you know, the mission set we've been given, which was a 30-minute notice to move medevac mandate to be able to rescue wounded peacekeepers and civilians in Mali. Really difficult task set, really difficult mission. But the execution of that in a safe, repeatable way, in an ethical way, was hugely important to me. And we achieved that. And then as a secondary outcome was, you know, allowing all of our team of peacekeepers to serve with dignity in Mali and achieve a really important operational effect for a mission that, you know, badly needed our help at the time. You know, I would say, you know, we achieved those and we brought everyone home. And so we achieved those two things because of the decisions we collectively made as a task force, and the quality of the decisions that we arrived at were informed by a more diverse group than I've ever served with. And I think that was really important. And I would look to the outcome of that mission, where we had everyone came home who served, even though it was a very violent and difficult place. And we had, you know, I think excellent decisions made as a result of the voices in the room, many of whom were female.
Great. Thank you. Those were perfect ending notes. I loved those popcorn tidbits. So I think that concludes our podcast, sadly. I honestly probably have so many more questions that in the back of my head I'm dying to ask, but in the essence of time, I should probably close it off then. But I wanted to thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today and to share these thoughts with the defense team and civilians. And I just think that this is just such a unique opportunity, as I said when we started, because how many chances do you get to talk to people who have been deployed and then further deployed on peacekeeping missions? And yeah, I think I'm just very humbled, I guess, by this conversation. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you, Hannah.
Merci.
Thank you for listening today. And a reminder that this is only part two in a three-part series hosted by the Department of National Defense and Canadian Armed Forces for the anniversary of UNSCR 1325.